From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans have learned in pretty dramatic fashion that trade deals are big deals. And there's a big one on the table right now, the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership. New rules for a dozen nations trading around the Pacific, representing 40% of the world's GDP. President Obama's pushing hard for it. Many Democrats are pushing back. It's coming to a head this hour on Point, the debate over the TPP. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do we need it? Are you for it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, I should say, we will look at the horrific loss of life in the Mediterranean this week as migrants struggle to cross from North Africa. It's just in the many hundreds, and Europe on fire with it. We will look at that. But first, the TPP. Joining me from New York for an overview is Tim Fernholz, politics and economics reporter for Quartz. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom.
So here we are. We've got a two-step going on, TPP, TPA. The first thing is this fast-track authority that would let this go to Congress for a simple up or down vote without any amendments that could unravel the whole thing. Where do we stand on that? There was a deal worked out last week. Will there be a vote? When?
So the deal was worked out last week by Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans are Paul Ryan in the House, Senator Orrin Hatch in the Senate, and Ron Wyden, the Democrat. And basically, yeah, they made a compromise. There's going to be a committee vote this week, and it looks like the bill is going to pass out of the committee and go to the floor sometime before the summer recess.
Here's out of the committee and to Congress. That's just for the fast-track authority, which is or is not tantamount to the ultimate green light.
It is not the ultimate green light here. And in fact, this fast track authority deal that they made is different from previous ones. And then there's a sort of an additional veto point and a lot more time before the vote, in part because of the skepticism you mentioned on the part of Democrats about this deal. So this is necessary to get the deal passed because mm-hmm. there will just be no opportunity for amendments, but it makes it easier for lawmakers to shut the whole process down.
Hearings on this today, the president paying a lot of attention to it last week. Here he was on Friday. This was at a meeting in the White House with the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. President Obama saying the TPP agreement is better than past agreements that the U.S. has learned.
People recognize that there have been circumstances in the past in which trade may have contributed to aggregate growth of the global economy or even the U.S. economy, but hurt workers. And we've learned lessons from that. And this Trade Promotion Authority, thanks to the work of Senator Wyden and Hatch, reflects some of those lessons.
Ron Wyden, Oregon, Orrin Hatch, Utah, of course, they were in on making this deal for the fast track that will be voted on before the whole thing is voted on. Tim Fernholz in New York, remind us of the big players here. You've got Canada and the United States and Mexico on this side of the Pacific. Plus, you've got, Chile, Peru, but it goes right on across. Japan, the biggest on the other side, plus Australia down there, Singapore, Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam.
I think you've got them all.
Did I get them all? New Zealand's in there.
And South Korea even just asked if they could get in on it, too.
Oh, have they? Even though we have a separate bilateral deal with South Korea, they may come in?
Well, actually, we have bilateral deals with a lot of the participants in this. Mexico, Canada, with Japan already, with Australia, New Zealand. So, you know, what this is basically it's the mother of all trade deals. It's taking a lot of individual free trade deals and making them into one huge market.
Why isn't China on that list if it's a trans-Pacific trade deal?
There's a lot of reasons, depending on who you ask, but two reasons are, one, China probably wouldn't want to meet a lot of the standards that the Obama administration wants for the TPP, particularly around state-owned enterprises and how they can behave, but also intellectual property, tariffs, the whole thing. And also because basically the Obama administration is portraying this as a way to sort of one-up China and sort of set the economic rules in that region for the next couple of decades. And there's a competing sort of Chinese-supported trade pact going on being negotiated right now as well.
What's that called?
Kind of a race. It's called the Regional Cooperative Economic Pact, or the RCEP.
The president very explicit about this kind of competition with China over who's going to set the rules for trade in this region. Again, from that meeting with the Italian Prime Minister on Friday, President Obama.
95% of the world's markets are outside our borders. The fastest growing markets, the most populous markets, are going to be in Asia. And if we do not help to shape the rules so that our businesses and our workers can compete in those markets, then China will set up rules that advantage Chinese workers and Chinese businesses.
The president making a big deal about who's going to set the table for trade here, the U.S. or China. Republican supporters, and they have been the biggest supporters of this. We'll hear Democratic dissent, absolutely. Paul Ryan was also in on this deal to try and to get fast-track approval through Congress. Here he was with that same theme about China with CNBC last week. Wisconsin Rep. Paul Ryan says the U.S. needs to be involved in trade agreements, trade deals like this one, the TPP.
And the question really here is, who is going to write the rules for the global economy? Is it going to be U.S. and our allies, or is it going to be China? That's one question. The other question is 96% of the world's consumers, Kelly, they don't live in America. They live in other countries. And if we want more jobs, if we want higher wages, we need to make more things, do more things here in America and sell them overseas. And that's why we need to open up markets.
Americans have been down this road before. So have some of their representatives. And we've heard some really striking statements from some Democratic congressmen and women here. But here's one. Senate Finance Committee hearing last Thursday. Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York saying he used to be into free trade and he's not anymore. He's changed.
I used to be a supporter of free trade. In fact, I lost the AFL-CIO endorsement in my congressional district several times because I supported free trade. I've changed.
He's changed. That's a pretty big statement. Tim Fernholz, how are the proponents and opponents of this deal lining up? What are the arguments being made?
Well, I will say Senator Schumer may have – his change may have more to do with his hopes of being the Senate Majority Leader in the next Congress necessarily than reevaluating the policy here.
Well, he's a politician after all.
Yeah, he sure is. But what's shaping up is you have Republicans who are generally predisposed to support free trade, but they are not predisposed to support President Obama, and getting this deal through would be a big accomplishment for him. And then you have the Democrats who have generally been skeptical of trade, even if, you know, Bill Clinton was one of the most free trade supporting presidents in recent memories.
1993, NAFTA, he pushed it through. It was an enormous push and a big deal.
And don't forget about China's ascension to the WTO, which wasn't a free trade deal, but helped get them access to our markets. But the Democrats, you know, they have labor unions, including support in the manufacturing states. They are supported by environmental groups who really question whether this is going to be good for the global environment or help climate change. And then you have this sort of evolving coalition of people who are concerned about digital issues, about intellectual property online, and whether this deal could affect net neutrality and things like that. So there's a whole array of people who are expressing very real concerns about the TPP on the Democratic side.
And the administration saying we need it, it will be good for the U.S. economy in their aggregate, though they concede there will be winners and losers, but also in this struggle for influence in the Pacific. It was interesting, Ash Carter, the new Secretary of Defense, this was talking at Arizona State University's McCain Institute just earlier this month. Listen to him talk about economic strength and TPP.
Our military strength ultimately rests on the foundation of a vibrant, unmatched and growing economy. TPP is so important because of its enormous promise for jobs and growth across our nation's economy.
And taking it right to the bottom line for the head of our defense infrastructure, saying it's equivalent to another aircraft carrier.
You might not expect to hear this from a Secretary of Defense, but in terms of the rebalance in its broadest sense, TPP is as important to me as another aircraft carrier. It would deepen our alliances and partnerships abroad and underscore our lasting commitment to the Asia Pacific, and would help us promote a global order that reflects both our interests and our values.
That's the Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, getting in on the trade deal debate. Sounds even bigger than another aircraft carrier to me. What are the prospects for this? We're going to look at it. We're going to unpack it here with two very knowledgeable observers in a moment, Tim. But what are the legislative prospects for this deal?
I think right now advocates of the deal are optimistic that the fast-track bill is going to pass and it's going to empower the Obama administration to negotiate this deal. It might be a tight vote. We're going to have to see. But the real question is going to be down the line when the TPP comes back and they have that up or down vote, whether it's going to pass then and there. So much of the negotiation has been going on in secret that very few people actually know what is in the deal. So it's going to depend on what they bring back and how they can sell it at the time. This new deal says it needs to be public. The fast track bill says the trade deal that's eventually negotiated will need to be public for 60 days before the vote. And that will give everyone a lot of time to really dig into it and attack it and fight it. So that's the vote that's going to be in the future and the real hard one.
Tim, what do we know broadly? I know there's a lot of detail that's not known, but a lot has come out. What do we know about who are likely to be winners in terms of economic sectors in this country and potential likely losers?
Well, the economic analysis pretty much suggests that manufacturing industry in particular, especially where it's labor intensive, is going to be the main loser. But the winners are going to be, again, I mean, and that's, you know, it's, you know, some people have said, is there any further for that sector to go down? And that's an interesting question. But yeah, what we're talking about basically is bringing a bunch of countries that have very cheap labor into a free trade agreement. With countries like the U.S., where our advantage is intellectual property and capital. So it's going to be capital-intensive industries, the pharmaceutical industry, services industry in particular.
Finance? Is that what that means when you say service? Do you mean finance or something else?
Finance will certainly benefit from this. The Wall Street is certainly behind this bill.
Agriculture, people are talking about as well, would benefit in the U.S. because it would open up, they hope, doors to more exports to Asia.
That is true. That is the hope. I've seen analysis suggesting the benefit will ultimately be neutral. I think it really depends on how much Japan gives in terms of their agricultural tariffs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal, coming before Congress, well, the authority for fast track very soon. And then before long, if that passes, the whole thing for an up or down vote, looking at the big debate over whether to go down the trade deal path again. A dozen countries in here, Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Japan, Chile, Australia, Peru, and right on down around the Pacific Rim, not China. That's part of the dance here. There's supporters. There are opponents. A lot of Democrats opposing. Here was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. This was on talking to CNN at a rally on Monday in Washington, blasting the deal.
Corporations have shut down tens of thousands of plants in America, gone to China and other low-wage countries. It's depressed wages, throwing American workers out on the street. It is a huge issue. And I think we've got to stand up and say enough is enough. We want corporate America to invest in the United States, not just in China, Mexico, and other low-wage countries.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and you hear all that. President Obama saying, look, globalization is a fact, whether we have this deal or not. We've already lost a lot of the manufacturing. That was inevitable. It's lower wage abroad. Here he was at the White House on Friday.
The point I've made to my labor friends and my progressive friends is that, you know, companies that are looking for just low-cost labor, they've already left. We're already at a disadvantage right now. And the trade agreement I'm proposing would actually strengthen our ability to force other markets open and strengthen our position compared to where we are right now.
Let's make the best of where we are, the president's saying there last week. Tim Fernholz is with us from Quartz. He's covering all of this. Proponent and opponent joining us now. Gordon Hanson is with us from San Diego, California, professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego, director of the Center on Emerging and Pacific Economies, chair in international economic relations there. Professor Hanson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
And from Washington, Lori Wallach joins us, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. She's been paying attention to trade deals for a long, long time. Lori Wallach, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you here, Lori. Gordon Hanson, if you would, make the case for, to begin with, why I believe you're backing this. Do you back it as it appears to be shaping up? And if Congress should vote for it, why?
Well, as Tim was mentioning, there are many details we don't know. Here's the main reason that I support this. We've spent the last 40 or 50 years or so negotiating trade deals with countries all around the world that affected one sector primarily, and that was manufacturing. We have opened our markets to manufacturing and now have rock-bottom barriers to those goods coming in. Our import tariffs on manufacturing goods average right around 2%. virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much left there to cut. What those previous trade deals have not done is open global markets to services and to agriculture, two areas in which the U.S. has a strong comparative advantage. So we've spent all of this time letting the rest of the world into our markets in an area where we're progressively weaker and haven't taken the initiative in pushing for access into other countries' markets in areas in which we're strong. So I see this agreement as removing those distortions that past agreements have created and leveling the playing field across the major sectors of the economy.
Are you suggesting it was a mistake to open manufacturing in that way and to lose it as we've done, or not?
It would have been preferable to open trade across all sectors simultaneously. The political realities at the time didn't allow that to happen. And this was, keep in mind that those agreements which opened barriers to trade, reduced barriers to trade, were primarily negotiated between rich countries, between the U.S., Europe, Japan. The emerging economies of the world weren't really at the table yet. That all changed in the 1990s. And so the arrival of China, of India, of Brazil as major players in global trade has upset the balance and made the trade rules that the U.S. spent decades negotiating less relevant for the current environment.
We opened up on manufacturing when we were at an advantage there, and we lost it. Could that happen again with services, with agriculture even?
No, those are areas where the U.S. is demonstrably strong. I mean, the manufacturing sectors that we lost were ones that were very labor intensive. The unfortunate reality of globalization is that you're going to win some and you're going to lose some. If you want to be able to expand in sectors of strength, in software, in designing semiconductors, in commercial aircraft, in accounting and finance and consulting services, you're going to lose some too. And what we've lost is a good chunk of U.S. manufacturing as a consequence of that opening.
Lori Wallach, there have been very, very strong statements against going down this road this time. You are not in the pro camp. You're against it. Why, Lori?
Well, fast track for the TPP would make it easier for corporations to offshore many more U.S. jobs and would push down our wages by throwing American workers into direct competition with workers in Vietnam, a TPP country, who make less than 60 cents an hour. Parts of the TPP have leaked. So if you look at WikiLeaks, mm-hmm. you can look, for instance, at the investment chapter, and you can see that the agreement has the same offshoring incentives, the incentives that make it easier and safer to relocate investment in jobs from the U.S., that NAFTA had, only a wider version of that. Or, for instance, the Obama administration's admitted what they're using as the so-called Great New Labor and Environmental Standards are actually just what Bush had in his agreements with Colombia and Korea that just last winter the Government Accountability Office said had failed to improve environmental and labor standards. The administration's admitted they're continuing the past trade agreements ban and buy America and buy local, which means not just would our jobs be offshored, but our tax dollars that the government would otherwise, under U.S. law, invest in buying products made here when the government buys stuff, would get offshored. And we know, because of the leaks, that this agreement would have the same rules that have been in past agreements that would require us to import food that doesn't meet U.S. safety standards, which is why you have this unprecedented breadth of consumer and environmental and family farm and small business and union groups all against fast track for the TPP.
Laura, are you saying when you're first worried about wages that there would be more manufacturing loss, or that these other sector services, for example, might also see themselves offshored to, Vietnam?
There would be more manufacturing job loss. I mean, if you look at what precisely the TPP would do, it would create offshoring incentives through the investment chapter, which, again, folks can go read on WikiLeaks' website, so that companies would feel secure to offshore to even lower wage venues than the past free trade agreements have provided special safeguards to do, Vietnam being the rock bottom, but Malaysia also being quite cheap. So just for instance, we were told the exact same promises 3 years ago for the Korea Free Trade Agreement, which also President Obama pushed. He said that agreement has new and special safeguards and protections. It will make sure we'll have, quote, more exports and more jobs. So that's the model, literally, that they put in the table, that text,
yep,
to negotiate the TPP. What's happened after 3 years? That agreement went into effect in March of 2012. U.S. trade deficit with Korea is up more than 80%. Our exports have declined. We've been slammed by another flood of imports, which sadly is just what's happened after each of the free trade agreements of the NAFTA model that we've done one after another since the 90s. Now, if you just take the actual trade data and you plug it into the ratio that the administration used back in 2011 to promise us that this agreement would be different, this one would create jobs, you plug in the data to their ratio and it equates to 84,000 more U.S. manufacturing jobs gone in the last 3 years. And this notion that somehow ag and services haven't been opened up and would be
abroad,
the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, you know, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, 20 years ago, actually included for the first time services and agriculture liberalization. And these agreements like Korea went to zero on tariffs for agriculture. But guess what? 3 years, our exports to Korea of agricultural products, the things we should have a comparative advantage in, zero gains, zero increase.
Lori, let me ask
you
something.
We've had a flood of new imports.
Yeah, we hear that. Why would this president, who was elected with a lot of backing from labor unions and obviously from Democrats, it's his party, why would he push so hard for this if it's as bad a deal as you suggest?
I think that what at this point has happened is he's 6 years into making this his big priority. He has talked up the agreement as a foreign policy issue when the economic case failed, because, you know, no one in Washington is buying the notion this would create jobs or help the economy. At the end of last year, the Department of Agriculture actually did a study, the Obama administration, of what the likely outcomes would be.
Yeah.
And they modeled a scenario that's not going to happen. They modeled a scenario where all tariffs in all sectors are totally eliminated. And they found the gain for the U.S. would be zero growth. Zero growth. That's the U.S. government.
Net
Obama
economic gain, you're saying.
Zero. Zero. U.S. Department of Agriculture.
What's your alternative, Laura? I mean, we've been told for decades now, if you don't, globalization is happening anyway. And if you don't get in there and steer the ship, you get all the impacts because the wages are still lower there. People will go for them, but you don't get to shape it at all. So, what's the alternative picture? Would you try and re-wall off America somehow with tariffs and have our own Shangri-La?
Of course not.
Well, then what?
It's exactly right that the question, the debate now, should not be about a yes or no on another NAFTA-style agreement, because we've seen that model offshores jobs and lower wages. The real discussion now should have been what President Obama said during his campaign, which is what are the new rules for the global economy? So very precisely, if folks want to see in detail the kind of trade agreement I would be lobbying for, mm-hmm. hoping to God would pass, mm-hmm. go to Thomas, the Library of Congress's website, and look up the Trade Act of 2009. It's a long piece of legislation that lays out exactly what would be in a trade agreement that would get the benefits of expanded trade, get our exports up, without having the offshoring incentives to send our good jobs offshore, and that would make sure there were enforceable standards to stop this race to the bottom in wages. And it would stop the piece of TPP that most people don't know about, which is, Tom, of the 29 chapters of TPP, only five have to do with trade. There's a whole darn chapter in there in a so-called free trade agreement that sets new monopoly patent extensions for big drug firms. So you have groups like AARP and consumer groups very worried, people who don't get in a trade fight typically, worried that this is going to jack up medicine prices for consumers. You got a whole chapter that rolls back financial regulation. unrelated to trade, has to do with how you can regulate banks and securities firms. You've got former member of Congress Barney Frank. You've got the current ranking member of the Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters. You have Senator Warren, all very upset about that notion of basically deregulating the financial sector and creating another crisis.
We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Larry Wallach, Gordon Hanson, Tim Fernholz, stand by. Lots of callers here. Susan in New York, Jamestown, New York. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, and I'm very glad for the opportunity to speak here. Mm-hmm. The thing that is concerning me very greatly is that it appears to me that the environment, once again, is going to be a major loser here. The environment, which is so essential to healthy lifestyles and so on. And the reason is my understanding that corporations who find that anything going on in communities, in states, in the United States, for example, that would interfere with their profit maximization would be able to bring suit, and that these small communities, et cetera, would be virtually powerless to prevent the corporations from putting through their wishes, and thus the environment again would be damaged, and who knows to what extent.
Susan, let us look at exactly that issue. Tim Fernholz, what about this issue of override of law, American law, through provisions of the TPP when it comes to the environment, Tim, and perhaps beyond?
So when it comes to changing American law, there's two things to realize. One is basically the whole big fight that Lori is talking about here on the non-trade side of things. So it's not tariffs, it's not market access, is this idea that if you're a business doing work around the globe, it's much easier for you if the laws are the same or fairly similar in all the countries where you operate. So the idea, you know, and it's ideal, is that let's make the pharmaceutical laws similar in all the places so we can just sell the drugs that we want to sell. However, what that becomes is this battlefield where the pharmaceutical interests want to use the trade deal to push the standards in the direction that they want most. And because this is a behind-closed-doors process, it's easier for them to influence that. The safeguard is that any changes the U.S. agrees to as part of the TPP, and you know, I've reported on this, we've seen it with intellectual property in particular, they would have to be passed as law by the Congress and the U.S. separately to implement them, even if the trade deal was passed.
Okay.
And that's happened in the past, but it's not automatic, I guess, is my point. And as Lori says, the leaked chapters of the TPP drafts have been pretty disappointing, at least comparing what the Obama administration's rhetoric has been to what's really happened. You know, the Obama administration will say about these leaked chapters that they don't represent, you know, the final output, or you don't know who said what. And, you know, we're going to see what's true when they eventually have to release this.
Gordon, we just got half a minute before the break, and I will come back to you. But do we have a horror show of hidden deals under the covers here, Gordon?
I don't think so. I think Tim said it well. If you want to conduct business in the international arena, you need some sense of stability in legal arrangements across borders. It's a tough process to harmonize these things. But without it, our corporations, which provide jobs, which provide income to American families, can't do business in the global arena.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. We're going to speak in a few minutes as well about those migrants that have gone down in the Mediterranean. Europe struggling with the waves coming across from North Africa right now and how to respond. Lori Wallach is with us, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, not a fan of the TPP. Gordon Hanson, University of California, San Diego, professor of economics there, says, yes, we need it. Tim Fernholz is covering it all for Quartz. All kinds of response here. Jim says online, Jim says, is this Obama's three-card Monty? Ben says, if it's anything like NAFTA, it needs to be stopped. Michael says, popular legislation is not always best. If we don't make the attempt to globalize, we may lose big later. Sylvia in Burlington, Vermont. Sylvia, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm for an agreement, but not this one.
Okay.
The banking lobby has already got in there, and Lori could refer to this. Apparently, there's about 100 pages of exemptions, and one of those exemptions is enough to negate the whole agreement. And I'd like to know what that is. Another thing, the reason why Schumer is for it is because he represents a very large banking...
But he says he's against it right now. Says he's against it at the moment. Yeah, at the moment he says he's changed on trade deals. He used to be for them, now he's not. So who knows where that ends up? I mean, there's a lot of distance to cover here yet. But let us pick up the banking front. Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts senator, was on the Senate floor talking about this investor-state dispute settlement provision of the TPP, the ISDS. Here she is.
Giving foreign corporations special rights to challenge our laws outside of our legal system is a bad deal. So long as TPP includes investor-state dispute settlement, the only winners will be international corporations.
There's Elizabeth Warren. On the other hand, got this big committee meeting today in Washington on this, AFL-CIO against it. We had the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahue, saying it would level the playing field, especially for small U.S. companies that export.
No one wants to go into a game many points behind before the tip-off, but that is exactly what American exporters are doing every day. These barriers are particularly burdensome for America's small and medium-sized companies, about 300,000 of which are exporters from the United States.
Unleash American small company exporters, says the Chamber of Commerce head right there. AFL CEO saying no fast track for this. I'll take it to Lori Wallach. But Gordon Hanson, what about this concern over exemptions in the financial services and banking arena? Do you have concerns there?
So think more generally about the predicament that U.S. corporations find themselves in right now. Mm-hmm. Look at Google. Mm-hmm. Google faced antitrust actions in the United States. The Department of Justice found that Google was not in violation. Guess what? The EU is hitting Google up now, and it's going to have to go through the entire process again. Japan might be next. Without some sort of harmonization, you have governments that can literally prey on successful companies. China has done this to successful exporters to its markets. It hit Qualcomm with $1 billion in fines after Qualcomm helped increase its exports of chipsets to the country's cell phone industry. So that's the risk we face without action of this type.
Is it worth it, Lori? Because we have seen those. We've seen Qualcomm. We've seen Google. That may not be perfect, but maybe we need it anyway. What about the banking exemptions Sylvia asks about?
Well, this goes to both Sylvia and the caller before about the environment. This is not, these non-trade rules are not about stability or harmonization. They impose, through the closed-door venue of the trade negotiations, policies that failed in the sunshine of Congress or state legislatures. And why is because Fast Track includes the creation of official trade advisory committees with 600 corporate advisors who get to see the text, who get to influence the process while the public is shut out. And Fast Track, which was created by Nixon, rarely used, I might add, hasn't even been allowed by Congress, but for five of the last 21 years, Fast Track is what opened the door to suddenly having really diplomatic legislating with these corporate advisors in secret to rewrite domestic laws. So it is the case that Congress has to implement the changes, but that's what the Fast Track fight's about. Will the president be able to negotiate agreements, sign it before Congress approves the substance, like the TPP that we know has all these unfortunate chapters with problems, sign and enter into it, write a bill implementing it, have a 90-day guaranteed vote on that bill, yes or no, with Congress's only role, that rubber stamp, after it's too late to do anything, which gets to the rollbacks. So the chapter folks are talking about is the investment chapter. That's the one that leaked on WikiLeaks.
Right.
And if you go to isdscorporateattacks.org, you can see a whole list of scores of these corporate tribunal attacks on environmental laws, food safety policies, financial stability, land use. This investor state system is one of the most pernicious aspects of TPP. And the problem is, if Congress approved Fast Track, we know for sure that not only would the TPP offshore our jobs and push down our wages, but thousands more corporations would get access to these tribunals staffed by three corporate attorneys, no outside appeal, to attack our domestic laws, not because they discriminate, but simply because they violate the new privileges that the TPP would give for foreign investors operating here not to have to meet the same laws that our domestic firms do.
Listed specifically
is financial service regulation and environment.
Let me put that to Gordon Hanson. That, you know, you listen to it, it sounds very concerning. It sounds like a competitive disadvantage potentially and a potential sacrifice of sovereignty. How do you see it, Gordon?
So whose companies in the world right now are most disadvantaged by the playing field that they confront? I think overwhelmingly it's U.S. companies. That is, when U.S. companies go abroad and succeed, what happens is governments create rules that claw back some of those profits. That clawback reduces demand for those workers at Google, at Apple, at Qualcomm, at IBM, which have been very successful in breaking into important high-tech and service markets abroad. So, you know, what Lori is talking about is something that Senator Elizabeth Warren has latched onto as a vehicle for trying to sink the entire ship. And there, you know, to be frank, there's some understandable concerns here. But the goal, the political goal, I think, here is to find a key area of vulnerability that resonates with the public and use this to kill trade promotion authority. Once that is done, TPP is over. Without Fast Track, there will be no trade deal. And I think that's the ultimate goal of the folks who are opposing the process.
Boy, this is a hot one, and it's not over. We're lifting the curtain on it just a bit today, and we're grateful to all of you for helping us do that. Gordon Hanson at UC San Diego, thanks. Let's talk again, but thank you for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks very much, Tom.
Lori Wallach, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Lori, thanks to you.
Thank you. Look forward to talking more about it.
And Tim Fernholz, do you still feel confident this is going to pass? Man, when you listen, it is hot.
It is very hot. I'm glad you took the time to dig in today.
You're running the numbers. You think it's likely to still get over the hump?
That's what people on the Hill say. They think that there will be enough Democrats to support the Republicans and get it over, but it's politics and anything can change.
We may all have to reconvene, Lori, Gordon, Tim, and see how this thing rolls. Tim Fernholz with Quartz, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
In a moment, migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. This is On Point. Over the weekend, hundreds of African migrants trying to reach Europe drowned in the Mediterranean off the coast of Libya. As many as 900 people are feared killed in the deadliest known shipwreck of migrants trying to reach Europe. Today, the ship's captain and a crew member were taken into custody on criminal charges. EU foreign ministers will meet on Thursday to discuss the crisis and ways to stop traffickers from squeezing hundreds of migrants into small boats. To look at the crisis, joining me now from Sicily in Italy is James McKenzie, chief correspondent in Italy for Reuters. James McKenzie, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, my pleasure.
I said Africans died, but as we look down the rolls here, it's not just Africans. You've got people coming, it looks like, from very far away through North Africa to get to Europe. What is driving this flood, James?
Yes, you do. If you look at the countries that people are coming from, it answers itself almost. This year alone, we've had more than 8,000 people come from Syria, 3,000-odd from Eritrea, and a similar number from Somalia, 2,000 from Afghanistan. These are all countries that are, you know, poverty and war. That's what's driving people, I think.
As far as Afghanistan, Pakistan, we heard. What's the latest on the ships that have been sinking and foundering now? Are there more rescue attempts still underway?
The flow is continuing. The Italian Coast Guard rescued another 600 people yesterday. There are a couple. There was a fishing boat in difficulty, which was being assisted this morning off the southern coast of Italy. We expected more arrivals tomorrow, probably in the eastern coast of Sicily. The crisis is continuing. The boats are still arriving at the moment. Yeah,
James, is there a new surge in these boats right at this moment, or are we just hearing about it because of the terrible, tragic sinking and huge loss of life?
The numbers are similar to what they're there. The numbers kind of rise and fall. Over the last couple of years, they have risen quite sharply. What's happened in the last couple of weeks is that the weather has got a bit better, and that encourages boats to leave. Overall, the situation, one of the key factors is the situation in Libya, which is now in a state of near anarchy, and that, you know, creates very favorable conditions for the people smugglers and migrant traffickers who organize these voyages. And I think, you know, that's a big factor behind the rise we've seen over the past couple of years.
We're hearing about arrests now, James McKenzie. Is that arrests of organizers of these illegal migrant smuggling operations, or those directly involved, pilot, captain, pilot, you name it?
Well, both have happened. The Italian police arrested 2 dozen or so people in the last couple of days over on accusations of being involved in a sort of, you know, organizing these voyages from out of North Africa into Italy, and once they're in Italy, sort of organizing the people who arrive. So they have attack the networks themselves. They haven't stopped it, but they have attacked it, and they have succeeded in arresting and identifying some of these people. The last the couple of arrests, the Tunisian captain of the ship which sank the other day, that's obviously a slightly different factor there. That's the person directly involved. He presumably is not going to be Mr. Big of the organization. He's a kind of seems to be a relatively small cog in the system. Well, that would be that's the accusation that's being made. He's responsible or accused of being responsible for this sinking, but he doesn't seem to be one of the organizers of it, if you see what I mean.
How is Europe looking to respond here? I've seen they've got a lot of things on the table, but are they looking to open up so that the ships don't wallow and people drown, or somehow to crack down, to shut off this flow?
Well, that's the policy dilemma they're facing. Because there are those who say that by increasing the rescue of operations, that encourages people to leave and hope that they'll be picked up if their boat gets into difficulty. That's an argument with the other side rejects entirely and says that since the Italian search and rescue operation called Mare Nostrum, a relatively big operation, was ended at the end of last year, the migrants have continued to arrive in very large numbers, and the only thing that's changed is that more of them are dying. What the European Union is proposing at the moment is to reinforce joint operations in the Mediterranean and devote more money and resources to them to strengthen what they're doing and to undertake a sort of systematic attempt to capture and destroy the vessels used by the smugglers. And that will involve, more money, more resources, more ships, more boats in the area. It's an operation whose details are still being worked out, but that's the kind of approach that the foreign ministers agreed in Luxembourg on Monday, and the heads of government are going to be discussing on Thursday.
But that goes more towards shutting this down. I mean, you're not talking about full boats. You're talking about trying to find the boats before they're loaded with migrants to destroy them.
Yes. It's to try and get them before they leave, and to seize them and to deprive them of the use of them. Of course, it's going to take more than simply the boats. There's the broader issue of what to do with people who come. Resettling them. How to stop people leaving in the first place, as it were. How to kind of control the you know this enormous pressure which is coming from these countries in difficulty, these people desperate to leave and desperate to get to Europe, and this is not a problem which is simply going to be addressed by taking on the migrant boats when they leave the coast of Libya. In a sense, that's a kind of that's one of the later stages of the process, as it were, to get a more comprehensive solution, they're really going to have to try and find something which goes further back than that, as well as combating the people traffickers, on the ground.
If you have to go all the way back to finding stability for Libya or resolving Syria or dealing with Pakistani poverty, it sounds fairly overwhelming, James.
That's the scale of the problem. Yeah, that's absolutely it. This is one of the most difficult policy challenges facing governments in the world today, because the pressure driving this is so deep-rooted and so hard to resolve, so impossible to resolve. And yet, simply by combating most sides recognize it, simply by stopping the migrant boats as such, that's really only a part of the problem.
Not enough in the end. James McKenzie, right there in Sicily, thank you so much with Reuters for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.